Thank you for listening to this podcast that is part of a series dedicated to the Impact Investing Week of Fonds News and Investment Officer. My name is Marije Groen, and in today's episode, active ownership is one of the fastest growing responsible investment strategies in listed equity globally, and for a good reason. It is generally regarded as one of the most effective mechanisms to reduce risks, maximize returns, and have a positive impact on society and the environment. Kimberly Lewis of Schroders puts it this way: active share ownership is not just looking at what investments are doing, but how they are doing day to day. But what does good active shareholding consist of, and what does it add for investors and companies? That is what I'll discuss with Kimberly Lewis. Kimberly is head of active ownership at Schroders. Kimberly, a very warm welcome to you. Good to have you.
Well, thank you. It's lovely to be here. Thanks for having me.
Kimberly, before we take a deep dive into today's topic, tell me, what does the head of active ownership at Schroders do first thing in the morning when she fires up her computer?
So, the first thing I do after grabbing my coffee and firing up my computer is I have a read of the news, even before I check my emails. In what we do in active ownership, it's very important to have a good sense of what's happening externally. Current events, politics, scandals, social unrest, all impact the expectations of our clients and how we will engage the companies in the corporate sector. So really having an understanding of what's happening in the outside world, which changes very quickly, is very important.
Right. So you're on top of it. You're on top of the news. Tell me, I was triggered by an article of yours in which you wrote that a good ESG policy actually starts with the G. And in this climate-driven capital cycle, many investors, and actually myself included, would have thought that you would have said the E was most important. Can you clarify?
Absolutely. Well, in my opinion, you don't get the E or the S to actually happen without having a solid G, right? The G oftentimes is not what, you know, you sort of think of. It doesn't usually make the headlines unless there's a big corporate governance scandal. However, it's one of these things that actually, if it's being done right, you won't hear too much about it. But if it's being done right, it will make the E and the S actually work. We think that ultimately, it is the board of directors who are accountable to shareholders, and it is their responsibility to oversee the overall strategy and support management in enacting E and an S strategy. So for us, things like the purpose and leadership, board composition, we look at remuneration, how the board is looking at opportunities and risks, and how the board engages stakeholders is all really important. And they're all indicators as how well they're going to oversee the E and the S.
Right. And then looking at all these factors that you just mentioned, in your view, when is a company well managed?
Well, there's a lot of indicators of when a company is well managed. It is, you know, and it's really a combination. And that's where it's important to do a couple of things. Look at sort of quantitative indicators. So you can, there's certain things you can look at on a board to make sure that, you know, whether it's its board composition, making sure that it's got a good diverse team with diversity of thoughts and experiences. So you can really kind of map out the board skills and experience and knowledge and demographics. But then also you can, indicators would also be how the board compensates its senior executives. So executive remuneration is a very hot but important topic because that does tell you what the management is being incentivized to do. And we really look at whether its remuneration is aligned with long-term shareholders. And then there's a sort of less quantitative, you know, do boards feel like they are, do we think that they have clear responsibilities? Is it developing a culture of purpose in a company, values? Is it overseeing the company's culture? Is one of these things that you can sort of tell more by qualitative information. And that's why having conversations with boards is also really important.
Right. Just wondering if the pandemic has given you any new insights about the quality of corporate management.
Absolutely. I mean, the pandemic has really given us so many insights. A lot of what you would hear is sort of around the S, obviously, you know, kind of health and safety and how a company is looking after its workers and mental wellness. But what's not as much discussed is what does that say about quality management? What is a good manager kind of look like? And we are seeing, particularly during AGM season, we are seeing very, very, we're seeing an interesting spectrum of approaches to managing the pandemic. And so some of the things we look at are, how is the executive team and the board, sort of looked after their staff and ensured health and safety and wellness during productivity. But also, we're looking at executive comp. And we're looking at, you know, there because of the pandemic, a lot of sectors, employees have been very hard hit. There have been redundancies, layoffs. In some cases, you have seen boards and executive teams not sort of had to feel that same pain that its employees have. So we look for compassionate, empathetic leaders. And the pandemic is surely one kind of way where we've seen kind of the leaders and laggards, I'll say.
Yeah, right. It's where leadership really shows because now they had to very much demonstrate it.
Absolutely. Crises are sometimes the best way to really, the best way to test one's leadership.
Right. So when we're talking about this active share ownership, what would you say is your definition of it? And also, why does it matter to investors and to companies?
Sure. Well, we describe active ownership at Schroders as three sort of activities. Dialogue, that's when we speak to companies to get an understanding of how prepared they are for the changing world. A lot of sort of information gathering, fact-finding between us and the companies. Then there's engagement. So that's when we engage with the companies. We speak to them to influence our behavior and influence their behavior and adapt sort of to the changing world. And then there's voting. And voting is where we actually have the ability in equities to use our voice to make sure these changes are happening. So engagement, dialogue, and voting are what we sort of consider the kind of the three prongs of active ownership. The reason why it's important is because we look over, as you sort of mentioned earlier, it's important that we look at not only what our investments are doing in terms of the total shareholders' returns, but how they're doing it day to day, which will ultimately protect and enhance our clients' investments in the long term.
Hmm. What can you say, Kimberly, about the impact of active ownership on total shareholder return and also ESG scores of a firm?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and it's much debated, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So look, you know, measuring the ESG impacts and actual TSR impact on alpha of active ownership has been challenging because the outcomes of engagements generally manifest in the long term, and it's very difficult to isolate ESG factors from other components that might contribute to a better bottom line. Nevertheless, there are a lot of studies which demonstrate some of the correlation between active ownership and TSR. Others, a bit more attenuated, trying to demonstrate a causation. We're doing our own research on that as well. It will, as I mentioned, it will be difficult to ultimately prove, but we certainly have seen the value of engagement for minimizing risk and also improving the dynamics, communicative dynamics, learning dynamics, political dynamics. So, you know, I think while reasonable people can disagree as to whether or not the TSR direct causation impact has been demonstrated, we certainly believe that it's risk mitigation and the process of communication and understanding the companies is best leveraged through active ownership.
Right. Then there's also shareholders resolutions. So can you maybe explain to us a bit more about shareholders resolutions and also why they are so important?
Sure, absolutely. So if you think of it, you know, as I mentioned, what we do is dialogue, engagement, and voting. And we have the opportunity to influence companies in all of those ways. But while engagement continues sort of through the year, Each annual general meeting season provides opportunities to send clear and public signals of our expectations to businesses. We actually get a vote, right? We vote on the directors. That is an extremely powerful tool to use that we treat and exercise very, very responsibly. Last year, we voted on almost 70,000 resolutions. We look at every resolution individually. Some of them we debate exhaustively with our research team and our fund managers and analysts, and we take it very seriously. We do appreciate, particularly, you know, there are many companies where we own quite a large percentage of the outstanding voting rights. But on every company, it is not lost on us how much impact the ability to actually vote on directors and on resolutions has.
Right. And I wanted to take an example here of one of the resolutions you actually voted against, the one by climate group Market Forces to stop the British bank Barclays from lending to fossil fuel companies. Can you tell us what was wrong, in your view, with that proposal?
Sure. You know, as many know, though, Barclays is one of the largest lenders to fossil fuel companies. But during 2020, it made significant commitments to align its business to a low carbon transition, right? This followed pressure from shareholders, including Schroders. We had been engaging Barclays many times prior to this resolution and had developed a relationship, a constructive engagement relationship with them. Largely as a result of our engagement, it is now one of less than a handful of large banks that have established targets related to a commitment to becoming net zero by 2050. And so it's the detail of the Market Forces resolution that was critical. We believed that forcing Barclays to take decisions based on phasing out the provision of financial services to fossil fuel projects could actually hinder its climate transition plans. So we felt a forced rethink of its climate strategy could potentially hinder its ability to support companies committed to transition and delay its progress towards the target it has set. You know, so we were concerned that the resolution did not distinguish adequately between groups that had established transition plans and that hadn't, and that would ultimately tie Barclays' hands. So ultimately, we thought that, pragmatically speaking, we would have more positive impact by supporting them than by mandating certain conditions.
Right. Thanks for clarifying that example. We're reaching already the end of this interview, Kimberly, but maybe as a final question, many stewardship codes and industry guidelines focus on local investors and on local companies, but investor portfolios and ESG issues span various countries at the same time, right? So how do you handle this?
Through a lot of internal discussion, debate, and attempts at alignment. Look, it's difficult, right? We are a global company with global investments, and we appreciate that in all aspects of ESG, local context is important. But at the same time, there are certain basic fundamental things that we stand for as a global company that should not be compromised. So we spend a lot of time thinking about kind of way balancing those two things. An example would be say, climate and how we're approaching our climate engagement. We now have five very specific expectations of all medium and large cap companies that we hold globally, right? We expect them to have Paris-aligned targets. We expect them to have clear transition plans. We expect them to have ESG measures in part of their executive compensation. And we are going to start engaging and escalating using our voting power for boards that actually don't do those things. However, appreciating that some regions are at different stages in their kind of advancement towards transition and different sort of stages of maturity, we do have different timescales for various regions. So we try to have global ambitions and global expectations, but then also be pragmatic and consider the local context in each of them.
Thank you so much, Kimberly, for telling us more about this active share ownership at Schroders. It was really a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me, likewise.
I would like to thank today's guest, Kimberly Lewis of Schroders, for her time and her insights. This podcast about unlocking value with active share ownership is offered to you by Schroders. It was recorded as part of a series dedicated to the Impact Week of Fonds News and Investment Officer. For more podcasts, please visit fondsevent.nl/podcasts. If you'd like to know more about taking active share ownership into account in investment decisions, please check out the Schroders website, schroders.nl.
Important information. This information is a marketing communication. No responsibility can be accepted for errors of fact or opinion. Past performance is not a guide to future performance and may not be repeated. The value of investments and the income from them may go down, as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Exchange rate changes may cause the value of investments to fall as well as rise. Issued by Schroder Investment Management Europe S.A., 5, Rue Hohenhof, L1736 Senegerberg, Luxembourg. Registration number B37.799.